Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up, we're going old school. We're going to talk about department stores in our first couple of stories. We'll also break out more news surrounding Walmart. How can you not after Walmart's earnings this week? And we'll talk Blue Apron and whether or not they still constitute a threat to the grocery industry. Thank you to all who listen to us, whether it be through iTunes, SoundCloud, Podbean, Spotify, or any of the podcast catchers out there. We appreciate the great feedback. Please keep it coming. We also have Twitter and Instagram accounts, too. They're a little lonely. They could use your help at Retail Podcast. We're brought to you this week by Blinkist, an app that distills the key insights of 2,500 best-selling nonfiction books into powerful 15-minute reads. Well, we start today's show with Macy's as they reported their third quarter earnings on Wednesday, and many, including us, were pleased with their results, and they even got some bearish analysts to kind of backtrack on some statements they had made previously about Macy's. Macy's, of course, the newer CEO in Jeff Gennette. A lot of people saying he was going to save the company, no less than Jim Cramer actually said that he might be able to save the company and turn the company around. We'll get into the financial marks in a bit, but their solid third quarter has reflected larger company themes, Leighton, that we have touched on in the past.
Yeah, Macy's was founded in 1858, so they are sort of an old dinosaur as far as retail is concerned, and they've been criticized heavily in the last couple of years, last 2 to 5 years, let's say, for not having evolved in the customer landscape that we see is going more digital and for not selling off some of their more valuable real estate holdings throughout the United States. Despite that criticism, they're still very profitable still, especially when compared to the other older mall-centric retailers that we talk about in Sears and we'll talk about in the next story in JCPenney. In-store efforts to better utilize their large amounts of space are also taking hold this quarter. And we'll talk about some of the initiatives going forward to maximize their sales floor space and to get customers staying in their stores and to be interested into other things while they shop around and what management deemed to be one of their most important quarters in their third quarter. Macy's beat estimates for their most recent period and raised guidance because of what they think will be a strong holiday season. And that too is going to be a theme here. Not only are we going to be talking about staple retailers, but we're going to be talking about a strong holiday season. And these are numbers we've been talking about in recent episodes as the NRF and other analysts have actually come out saying that expect sales to be better than ever. And I think Macy's is on board with that, trying to take advantage of every dollar spent. Reinvestment within Macy's is resulted and culminated this quarter, really bringing to light all important user metrics and trying to build up that user experience as customers try to interface with their digital and brick and mortar initiatives. But last week, we discussed how some investment services firms have really matched or raised expectations for the total amount of holiday sales coming in this year, in large part due to larger retailers' omni-channel functionality. And this is exactly what they've been spending money in. Macy's has really poured a lot of resources in to their digital networks, and they say they want this streamlined experience to where you can have buy online, pick up in store, really as a seamless integration of what they've already been doing. But we see that a lot of people are saying discretionary income is going to be up 5 to 6%. Macy's has been extremely direct with their strategy to funnel resources into digital sales. And again, like I said, Macy's has been extremely direct with their strategy up to this point. They promoted that buy online, pick up in store heavily on Macy's.com. But we turn to those all important digital sales, and they certainly played a role in their top line figures this quarter. They saw a major jump positivity from media outlets. In fact, a lot of media outlets backtracking previous statements that they were saying that were really negative about the company, saying they, like I said earlier, were not evolving to the capacity of others. And executive confidence in these earnings remarks no doubt played a role in the positivity this week, with CEO Jeff Gennette telling CNBC that they were ready for the holiday season and that he thinks, and I quote, "The backdrop for consumer spending is good, consumer confidence is strong, and their dot-com business is really humming along." And for their stores, he says, they're going into the fourth quarter in a healthy pace and with momentum. The quarter, compounded with these positive headlines, saw Macy's shares climb 2% earlier on Wednesday this week. However, larger market volatility caused shares to fall below pre-earnings levels on Thursday, which worried some. However, regardless of the past three-month downturn for the stock, shares are up 23% year-to-date and up over 80% over the past 52 weeks.
Let's get to the financial results now, as adjusted earnings per share came in at 27 cents versus the expected 14 cents, and GAAP net income hit $62 million. That's up 106% versus their third quarter of 2017. Gross margin dollars in the quarter of $2.2 billion. Their gross margin rate of 40.3% of net sales was flat to last year. Now, revenue came in $10 million short versus Wall Street guesses, clocking in at $5.4 billion. Revenue was up, though, still 2.2% over last year. And keep in mind, isn't exactly a retailer that's building out new stores. So when you see revenue being up 2.2%, well, that tells you that same-store sales must have been up, and that would have been correct. Same-store sales were up 3.3% amongst all of their store banners, coming in around 50 basis points higher than consensus expectations. The average comps for owned stores, so that leaves out the licensed outlets, came in at 3.1%. This is a function almost entirely of total transactions, which were up 3.8% in the quarter. So bringing more people into the stores, alternatively, some people spending money at Macy's more often throughout the quarter. So this is reflecting strong customer demand with both online offerings and in-store offerings. Average units per transaction, so the number of items sold per transaction, those were down at 3.1%. Average unit retail price, though, was up 2.6%, helping to counteract that number somewhat. That was driven by more regular priced items selling versus a year ago. You look back a year ago, there was a heavy discounting climate, not only amongst Macy's, but also other department stores. You're starting to see some of that roll back. As Layton said, more of that disposable income starting to filter into people's pockets. So not the reasons to entice people to come in and buy at a lower price that there were a year or even 2 years ago. Let's talk about their digital sales. Their digital sales were up double digits. That was in line with pretty much every other retailer that's put some type of energy behind their e-commerce business. We'll talk about Walmart here in a bit and their eye-popping numbers. Even though this was a highlight for many, including a lot of analysts who wrote articles after the earnings announcement, the slight revenue miss on the back of stronger brick and mortar sales overall suggested they came in maybe just a bit short on the digital front versus prior analyst estimates. And coinciding with that thought, Global Data Retail Managing Director Neil Saunders, again, one of our favorite analysts to quote here on the show, said, and I quote, "This is only the start of Macy's journey." And he also mentioned that he feels like a lot more work is still needed to make Macy's a unique and compelling retail destination, end quote there. We personally would like to see them break out the different revenue streams, kind of divide that up going forward. But despite this, executives believe that they're ready for the increased traffic over the next 2 months, both on web and in store, because they're confident in their mobile app and also the in-store tools that they've enabled now and are able to bring to the table. Brick and mortar and the digital experience, according to management at least, are designed to work hand in hand, and they feel as though this true omnichannel approach will help to smooth over any friction points that may come up during the holiday shopping season. Now, the best news for us is that all of their banners and concepts are performing with strength. This is not something you see very often in the department store space. Sometimes there is one banner leading the way. Oftentimes, over the past couple of years, it's been an outlet banner, for example. But Macy's, Bloomingdale's, and their makeup staple Blue Mercury, all three pleased management from the revenue perspective. For Macy's, you know, brick and mortar, let's face it, it's here to stay. And the thought that having a physical presence has lifetime value for customers seemed to be a sticking point on this earnings call. We would tend to agree with that. We were favorable in terms of Macy's programs a few years back in terms of selling out some of their large square footage stores, unlocking the value in some of their large square footage stores' real estate. And we feel like their real estate portfolio with their brick and mortar presence is a bit more manageable now than where it was the same point in, say, 2015. Also, a more robust loyalty program has helped, they feel like, to bring customers to their stores more frequently. Like we noted last week with GNC earnings, loyalty memberships do tend to increase average spend per customer per year. But again, as we talked about with the GNC earnings, your customers actually have to be using that loyalty program and using it to spend money. And at Macy's, so far, it looks like that is the case. They've expanded their loyalty program. There's actually a new gender-neutral tier that came out earlier this year. It's branded as the Bronze Program. Already for the company, it's showing strong early results as they've added nearly 2 million new members to that loyalty program tier.
We mentioned how their banners are exceeding internal top-line expectations, but one banner, if you could call it that, because it is not a standalone concept and wasn't immediately mentioned on the call, was Macy's off-price concept Backstage. Backstage is more or less a Nordstrom Rack competitor, so a little bit off-price there, like we said, but is strictly a store within a store concept where they can be placed in different existing areas and larger conventional Macy's stores throughout the U.S., with a lesser and varying square footage requirement. So they have that flexibility that is sort of inherent to Backstage now. While we are not given the exact sales figures for this banner, we can see that the revenue must be fairly strong considering the fact that they keep growing the concept. It's actually one of their major strategic priorities now. They can grow the amount of units in the U.S. faster and take over the larger store formats that they have in their portfolio. And year to date, Trent, the company opened 121 locations, 60 of those. So nearly half of the ones so far have been opened in the third quarter. And they now have 166 locations and they are putting more marketing dollars behind it to grow that traffic. But think about this, if you grow that traffic, guess what? You're also growing the sales to the conventional parts of your store. So sort of a win-win as they see it, because people, whether or not they're strictly just interested in the Backstage concept, will have to mull through the store and the other offerings to get there in order to shop. But coinciding with the better use of store space, management spoke about a transformative brick and mortar initiative that sees four locations becoming what they call neighborhood centers. CEO Jeanette told CNBC that he wants vibrant stores and that it is all about fulfillment and the ease of use with their digital efforts. So this is sort of a two-pronged approach, if you will. He wants to see space for digital orders, essentially taking over some of the old stagnant sales floor space. The same line of thinking that we're seeing at Target, maybe less so because their stores sometimes aren't as big. But as we enter into the key time of the year here, where we're funneling staff and resources into omnichannel efforts, this is extremely important for Macy's. They basically want more space to have for those fulfillment inventories. And so also with this, the key distinction here is that Macy's will be trying what other general merchandise retailers have been doing for years. And while Macy's is a department store, they're not a general merchandise retailer, they certainly are trying to pull out all stops for their bigger stores. They're trying to build out partnerships with other shops like Starbucks to drive traffic, or at least make current customers stay here longer at their stores and mull around. And this makes sense because a lot of stores have been doing this. If they figure that an average customer is going to spend 2 to 3 hours in store, you have to give them something to keep them there now. A lot of people like to come and go as they please, and I think having a Starbucks in these larger locations is the smart move. I would like to see more than just four locations becoming neighborhood centers, but certainly this is more of a pilot concept for Macy's. They already have relationships, by the way, with Starbucks and Sunglass Hut in a couple of their locations, and all of this is really playing to counter the push from massive investors to pay off debt and expenses with massive real estate holding sell-offs. Rather than sell, they themselves could be getting rent while at the same time making customers explore their stores during all times of the year, not just the busy seasonal ones. So in my opinion, this is a win-win because you're unlocking value without really having to divest your major stores, your major shopping hubs that people have been really coming to know for years now.
And this is a method that several department stores are using, not the least of which Kohl's. We've talked about their partnership with Aldi, but also their partnerships with other businesses as they try to unlock some of maybe that underutilized square footage within their large square footage stores. Now, the last initiative we'll talk about as far as Macy's is concerned is their Vendor Direct system. This system allows customers to peruse a larger online assortment, and Macy's hopes will better predict what the customer may want to look at based on previous searches. Nothing groundbreaking here on the search front, because after all, namely, Amazon has used this approach for a while, but Macy's is using this Vendor Direct as a data tool to procure different potentially trending items for their brick and mortar store. So it's not just about search functionality here. They're mining through the data to find different products that will work in their stores. And oftentimes, we've actually had interview guests in the past on the podcast talk about this very thing when it comes to product sourcing for stores that sell largely clothing. It used to be a process where oftentimes you have these buyers that are supposed to be the trendsetters. Now it's a lot more crowdsourced with data like this, and that's what Macy's wants. They want to have more niche categories in their stores above and beyond what the buyers might be pushing to those stores or thinking that might be the next big thing as it pertains to fashion or clothing. Now, shares as of Thursday were hanging around the $32 mark, and it wasn't that long ago, as we kind of led off this story with, about 18 months ago, you would have never thought shares would make it back to that $32 mark. Market cap of $9.9 billion with a price-to-earnings ratio of 10, so still a very modest price-to-earnings ratio, and a dividend yield of 4.69%, because like we said, they still churn out plenty of cash, and they have a lot of institutional investors as well, as far as shareholders are concerned. That's a big reason why they keep that dividend healthy and keep that around. Well, while Macy's did well in the department store space, JCPenney continued its slide in their third quarter. Shares of JCPenney initially fell 10% on Thursday to major lows for the company. Shares have hovered just over $1 per share. And again, we talk about 2-3 years ago, Macy's able to increase the share price from that point. Well, JCPenney was around the $7 to $8 mark about that long ago, now just $1 per share. However, the overall market turnaround that we saw helped to swing the stock back up 10% versus pre-earnings levels. Overall, it was about a 20% swing that really showed the type of rhetoric that has surrounded the company and how it's affected the stock price week to week, in that it seems like every week analysts have a different take on where this company is headed. One thing is for sure, though, Leighton, is that their third quarter certainly didn't show the strength quite yet that might be apparent under Jill Soltau.
Certainly a lot of volatility with JCPenney, and a lot of it is due to executive transitions. And we can see that new leadership can maybe turn around the company, but maybe not. And I think that's what the big speculation is about, right? Is the questions surrounding that new leadership and whether or not they can really turn the company around and make it profitable. And this is something we'll talk about in this story, because remarks by the new CEO, Jill Soltau, the former CEO of Joann Stores, seems extremely bullish on the idea that this iconic retail brand can do what's needed to be done to turn sales around and make those sales more profitable. But the CEO position was left vacant by now Lowe's CEO Marvin Ellison, and he's reportedly been having some issues with Lowe's, but it's a different space entirely. And with this department store, we see that Joann Fabrics is a little bit different, so Jill Soltau does have her work cut out for her, but there are category similarities if you look back into her prior retail history. The 116-year-old JCPenney will see Soltau take decades of high-level experience from a number of retail outlets that are still in business today, Shopko and Sears to name two. And yes, we do realize that Sears is still barely doing business, but they are still alive for what it's worth. Taking a short step back, JCPenney was expected to be profitable at the start of this calendar year, but continued inventory hiccups and a changing executive team has made it harder to profit. On top of this, the company has failed to pay back debt as much as they said they would, and this has led to higher interest expense than some, including us, had expected near the end of 2017 and headed into 2018. Their high level of long-term debt is very worrisome for us. Billions of dollars of long-term debt, I believe around $3 to $4 billion in long-term debt. And even if they turn around the recent stagnated or often declining quarterly sales in the meantime, those sales have to be very profitable to pay that debt back very aggressively, like, again, how they had planned to in the beginning of the year. But speaking of sales, JCPenney turned in third quarter sales, their most recent period, that decreased 5.8% to $2.65 billion. This compares to $2.82 billion for the third quarter ended October 28th of 2017. Wall Street this quarter expected flat revenues, and This really means that the company came in $170 million shy of consensus estimates. And so we look for reference. This is roughly half the quarterly revenue of Macy's, which is pretty worrisome if you compare the store count. Macy's, even though a lot of their stores are much bigger and in much better areas, in our opinion, they have 690 stores throughout the United States. JCPenney has 860 stores. So this means a lot less revenue per store. And again, they do have sort of a different concept. And Macy's, for their part, like we said, has been expanding their digital footprint massively over the last few quarters, reflecting the calendar shift in 2018 due to a 53rd week in 2017. We have to adjust there. Comparable sales still decreased 4.5%. Soltau was honest but hopeful in a prepared company release on their website. She said, "In spite of our overall sales results, I am encouraged by the recent underlying trends in key businesses such as women's apparel, active, special sizes, and fine jewelry." She said, "We are making progress and taking the necessary steps to right-size their inventory positions to better support the brands and categories that are demonstrating profitable sales growth." So basically, this is going to be a theme here for JCPenney. They have to identify the right products and make sure that those gross margins are heavy enough to transform the company and create a more robust bottom line. But she mentioned profitability just there, and it is natural that we highlight the latest earnings or lack thereof for the third quarter. They reported adjusted earnings per share of 52 cents, coming in 4 cents better than analyst expectations. GAAP net losses for the quarter ticked in at a whopping $151 million. This was higher than we expected for the company, Trent, and because the U.S. department store sales momentum we've seen over the last couple of quarters for other retailers, we did expect better, especially when comparing to 2017, where they reported a GAAP net loss of $125 million. So year over year, they increased that net loss. And again, this is on the backdrop of a very strong economy and in the face of competition that is done quite well despite pricing pressures.
And you look back, this is a company that was profitable, not just in select quarters, but for a full year, not that long ago. Now, granted, they had struggled before hitting that profitability, but I think in this circumstance, we were kind of talking about this before we came on to record, Soltau did inherit not the best of circumstances. She's very optimistic about what they can do going forward, but it just appears as though Marvin Ellison in his last year was throwing spaghetti at the wall, seeing what would stick, and it left the company in a worse position for it. And as you mentioned, I'm kind of anxious to see where he goes with Lowe's, because at this point, all we have is basically base our perception of his ability to be a retail CEO on performance. And certainly his last year with JCPenney is kind of like a coach of a sporting outfit that gets fired, even though he had success in the distant past, just hadn't had success lately. And I think it's a net negative in terms of where JCPenney is at right now, though better than where Ron Johnson left the company so many years ago. Now, despite the company paying out less with their corporate staff, SG&A expenses, or selling, general, and administrative expenses for the third quarter, did rise to 33.3% of sales, compared to 32.7% of sales in the third quarter last year. Inventory, that was down 5.4%, showing that they are perhaps doing a better job at selling through without aggressive clearancing, something that they had been doing at the beginning of this calendar year, despite the good faith efforts to buy merchandise cautiously. We were told a year and a half ago that they wouldn't see any more inventory problems, that they were on top of things. Well, we found out this year that wasn't the case, but good on the company to show inventory down at least quarter over quarter in this third quarter. Also a legitimate positive, something Soltau mentioned in her comments on the earnings call, was that women's apparel did perform well. And that's a category that honestly suffered some market share losses in their second quarter, but also over about the last four quarters as well. Jewelry, women's apparel, and men's were the company's top performing divisions during the quarter, notably absent from those inclusions. Appliances, which again, such a big push was made surrounding appliances a little over a year ago. Now, Soltau made it clear on this earnings call that she has a lot to learn about the company. She's just stepping in, after all, and will be looking at every possible way to make the company stronger and, the big thing, profitable. They want to pay down that debt that's been bogging down JCPenney's statements for so long. She spoke of merchandising promotional cadence as well, and trying to improve forecasting and using data to better leverage the company's capabilities. She basically checked off most of the boxes that you would have in terms of a buzzword bingo for department stores, but the key is she wants to restore the brand. She understands that significance of the American retail institution that is JCPenney, and just like all the other JCP fans out there, they don't want to see it go the way of Sears. And she said a complete strategy is going to take time to cultivate, but in the interim, she wants teams to move relatively quickly once they have acknowledged areas in which they can improve. Communication, also key for Soultown going forward, something that's highlighted throughout and something that she did a lot of in terms of stressing the importance of when she was at Joann, a dialogue not only with company employees between them and upper management, but also a transparent message for the customers. Again, there was a kind of idea ADD there going on with JCPenney. On one hand, it was appliances, then it was toys, then it was another thing to try and use up some of that vacant square footage, the Sephora concept, all of that. Again, a lot of spaghetti thrown at the wall, but she thinks it's important for customers and shareholders to get the right idea and a unified idea of the company going forward.
The vibe we get is that identifying the right merchandise will be key for the executive team here. This, of course, is something that we have talked about at length during the Ellison era, but they didn't execute well, and we saw that during this year's fiscal first quarter. Finding the right merchandise means the inventory levels will, of course, be kept in check because your inventory turn rate is going to be much better, and gross margins are going to be kept in check as well because the company won't have to use aggressive markdowns to move that merchandise. But also, once they are confident in the assortment front, this is something that we want to tie in here. Advertising and promoting the products will be a little bit better because they'll have more confidence in their trust in the items. They can actually be able to identify specific items to promote. And you counter that right now, the promotion seems to be encompassing a more blanketed approach. And this is exactly what Trent and I have seen through TV and audio advertisements. They are promoting sales on entire categories versus just a few hot or trending items, which I think is what they want to get to. But JCPenney took out their earnings expectations for fiscal 2018. So as we look ahead to the end of the fourth quarter, they really don't have solid guidance, but they did update their forecast for store comps to grow at low single-digit rates. It's expected that they'll have positive free cash flow for the full fiscal year. They may have liquidity issues if you look at some of their ability to pay back some of this debt long term, because they have almost $2 billion in cash and cash equivalents on hand right now with financing available. But you look at how much they're able to actually have in terms of net losses quarter over quarter. This is not a sustainable business. They really do have to turn it around. And at first glance, it might seem like a bad thing to withdraw full year guidance. However, the company did explain, and did so in a very transparent way, that it's doing so because of the new CEO and interim CFO positions, and that it's simply not fair to assess guidance relative to previous goals as they are getting a renewed look at the company's overall position in the market and their current financial status. So in my opinion, this totally makes sense, but it would behoove them to get that guidance out to the public sooner than later than to have all of those question marks, because we know one thing is a certainty in the stock market, and that is the unknown creates volatility, and this company does not need any more volatility.
You know, 88% of financially successful people read at least 30 minutes per day. They're hungry for knowledge, continuously seek self-improvement and learning every chance they get. And our sponsor, Blinkist, gets you there faster than you can imagine. Look, if you're like me, I've got a never-ending list of books people have recommended to me or that I've put on my own personal list to read, and I don't have time to read them all. I know you probably don't have time to read all the books you want to read either. Our sponsor, Blinkist, has solved that long list of must-reads once and for all.
Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books out there and distills them down to their most impactful moments so you can read or listen to them in just under 15 minutes, all on your phone or tablet. With Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere. And personally, Trent, I like to listen to Blinkist while I'm at work because my job is fairly mindless, or when I'm at the gym while I'm on the elliptical for about 15-20 minutes. And the Blinkist library is massive, from timeless classics like Freakonomics to Amazon's current bestsellers like Getting Things Done. They have pretty much all you need if you have 15 minutes or less to gain some knowledge.
And you know, one of my personal favorites is The Power of Habit, just like the habits that Leighton has, hitting the elliptical on a regular basis at the gym. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience, for you guys listening to the Retail Focus podcast. So go to Blinkist.com/retail to start your 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/retail to start your 7-day trial for free. You can cancel anytime. That's Blinkist.com/retail.
On with retail powerhouse Walmart, as they saw sales and domestic comps rise yet again as they prepare for battle with the retailers we just discussed in the coming 2 months. As one person on our Twitter feed said, the empire strikes back, and Walmart is still by far the number one retailer in the United States, and we'll get into those numbers. And like with Macy's and Home Depot this week, they did raise their full year guidance, really instilling confidence in their long-term shareholders. Their current tracking of sales has given them increased levels of confidence as they head into the biggest time of the year. They have a lot of momentum, reportedly, in the first quarter for their fiscal fourth quarter this year. Walmart's report on Thursday showed more of the same in terms of how they've been investing, but also how prior investments into the digital front are taking hold, particularly in grocery and the larger e-commerce initiatives. And as we'll note later in this story, investment can simply mean keeping prices low and taking near-term gross margin reduction in order to be the number one low-price retailer. But Walmart, with stock ticker WMT, posted revenues this week of $124.89 billion, falling almost $1 billion short of the consensus figures that we saw out there. But they saw $96.1 billion worth of sales in the U.S. Amazon, the competitor everybody talks about and the competitor that we talk about, saw the net product sales, including international sales, hit $33.75 billion in their third quarter. And I say that to say this. The U.S. sales for Walmart were almost $100 billion, while all of total product sales for Amazon were almost a third of that. A bit of a divide, we'll say. On a current currency basis, revenues were up 2.4% year over year for Walmart. Currency translation did hurt them. The strong dollar is apparent as interest rates continue to rise, and they rise because of that dynamic here with investors really getting out of the equities markets sometimes and looking to bonds as yields continue to rise there. And this devalues other currencies as that demand shifts. International revenue, as a result, was down 2%. International same-store sales, however, on constant currency basis, were up in 9 out of 10 markets they break out internationally. Going back 8 to 10 years, international was said to be their route to long-term sustainability and growth. However, it seems as though growth through acquisition overseas has become less lucrative than trying to take a bigger chunk out of this domestic e-commerce market. Net income for the company hit $1.71 billion, slightly less than last year's $1.75 billion. Adjusted earnings per share hit $1.08, a 7-cent beat versus Wall Street expectations.
And we saved the best number for last, at least for us. Comp sales in the U.S. hit a sturdy 3.4% increase, which first is dramatic for a mature retailer like Walmart, but that's 30 basis points higher than Wall Street's estimates. I think that speaks to a couple of things. One, of course, is execution on Walmart's front, but two, just how robust the current retail climate is in the United States. If you had asked someone 10 years ago what type of retailer Walmart was, well, they might have told you that Walmart was maybe a value retailer, a discount retailer, someone that might not be completely negative beta, but at least able to withstand fluctuations up and down with the market. And we see here that Walmart does fluctuate with the current economy a little more than people thought they did at least 5 to 10 years ago. From the operating expense side of the income statement, higher than usual incentive pay, something that we may see a continuation of if they continue to perform well. This makes us believe that they can behave at least at times like a bit of a younger, leaner company as they grow out certain areas. Now, those comps, that 3.4% increase quarter over last year's quarter, as everyone has noted this week. Rose for the 16th consecutive quarter. Likely to see that not change, at least for the foreseeable future, even if they slip down a bit to the 1% to 2% range as they come up on tougher periods, which they should do in a couple of quarters, is we've started to see those high 2, low 3% comps about a year ago. Traffic up 1.2% and transaction amounts saw a 2.2% rise. So they're seeing both more people come through their doors, more people log on to the website, but also people are spending more money when they do so. Breaking out a look at Sam's Club by itself, Sam's Club sales rose a steady 3.2% as well. And again, this is something where even when we look about a year ago where Sam's Club was positioned, we would have been hard-pressed to find that 3.2% increase for them a year out. But here we are in Sam's Club, still rising despite some hiccups on that front and despite the fact that they're still losing out in terms of market share to Costco, whose same-store sales are typically rising a bit more than Sam's Club over the past 3 years. Now, the rise in average transaction, according to Walmart's VP of Investor Relations, was not a function of inflation. And this is interesting because, again, you're seeing inflation come in around 1% to 2%. Transactions saw a 2.2% rise. But even though the percent increase in ticket is more or less what we're seeing in terms of annualized inflation metrics, Walmart said that their investment in price has seen them actually not raise prices by much, even though they are seeing higher input costs. What we're basically seeing here is a trimming of margins, and it seems as though the company is okay with taking a short to midterm gross margin hit to beat out their major competitors with similar economies of scale. Think companies like Kroger, Albertsons Safeway, Target, and of course, the aforementioned Costco. Now, for the record, they did say grocery inflation was not really a thing to this point outside of meat and dairy. We've been talking about grocery inflation now for a few years, actually grocery deflation, for most of 2017. We figured we would see inflation early on in 2018. That didn't really come about, but now we're starting to see it in earnest with a few categories, not necessarily categories like produce or other staple goods, but meat and dairy going up. And Layton can attest, I know his groceries at big box stores haven't gone up at all over the past few years, meaning they've actually decreased with respect to inflation throughout the rest of the economy over the same timetable. And I can certainly attest to that as well as someone who is lactose intolerant, so I don't buy dairy, and as someone who doesn't buy a lot of meat, it seems as though the prices I'm paying are also a little bit more stable. Now, that being said, Walmart, that transaction increase stands out a little bit more when you know that they aren't really raising prices to go along with inflation in other goods, as they haven't seen that inflation in grocery. And their increase in prices in general merchandise hasn't been notable.
This really is a story about execution, and CEO Doug McMillon said as much in a prepared statement. He also attributed a strong, spend-heavy consumer in the midst of a generally healthy economic environment. And like we said at the top, this is really about grocery and e-commerce growth. And I've been shopping at Walmart here recently for the first time in a long time, thanks to some promotions with grocery pickup. Walmart now boasts of having 600 locations with delivery and over 2,100 locations with grocery pickup. And this coincides with the goals they had previously outlined, and they are sticking to that, which really points to that execution point. Both are expanding at a rapid pace to meet the larger goals of having broader U.S. access to these grocery-oriented services. And Brett Biggs, their CFO, said grocery was, in fact, an integral part of positive comps this quarter as more people sought to use the aforementioned buying options with groceries. And I think this really speaks to the fact that they don't need inflation like other grocers do, like Kroger or, like you said, Trent, with Albertsons Safeway. You look at this company as one that looks to just take market share as opposed to trying to get every little piece that they can in terms of trying to pass on the cost to consumers. But those higher input costs, this really doesn't deter them from having the strategy of having the lowest grocery items on the market for the general consumer. And in the analyst Q&A, the question of their private brand penetration was actually brought up, and this again, is really along the same lines as keeping costs low. They are really bullish on their private brands. And unlike with Kroger, they actually don't break out their private label sales, at least for the public. Of course, they probably have internal metrics that they can really go off of and relate to quarter after quarter. But Walmart said that they did have strength, or they did note strength, in private label assortments, both in Walmart and Sam's Club, where they have consolidated their branding. And we know that that consolidation worried some, because this was sort of a big push for them, at least in Sam's Club years ago, but it is supposedly turned out well. Again, we don't have sales figures that are broken out, but we can take management's word that their private label brands are going stronger than ever. We would have liked to see more numbers for things that were top of mind for many. Execs had very little answers, not just the private label brand breaking out, but the direction of Flipkart even. They really offered very little evidence as to what they're going to do with that acquisition. They, again, own a majority stake now in Flipkart. They're still paying for that. But the absolute number also for hurricane-related expenses was not really talked about. They said, yes, we did incur some expenses that were related to the recent damage that was inflicted by the hurricanes. But while it's not required, it would have been nice to have helped shed light on the missed sales opportunities on the East Coast. Or for that matter, maybe some increased sales opportunities that happened during the rebuilding phase that is actually still going on to this day. So I say happened, but there's a lot of people that are still in distress that still need day-to-day items to rebuild. And leading into e-commerce, they really don't break out category sales either from online purchases. Yet another thing we were disappointed in this quarter. They get asked that nearly every single quarter from analysts, but this would give us a deeper insight into their online grocery market share, which would have to be, you would think, near the top end in the United States, even in the face of Kroger's ClickList program, which has been spreading like wildfire, and Target's DriveUp program. We understand that they do have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to not release figures in order to keep that competitive edge, something they mentioned as far as breaking out online grocery sales, but it is still disappointing from our analysis perspective. That e-commerce revenue did expand 43%, and we should have mentioned this earlier, but this was something that pretty much everybody has already talked about in the mainstream media. This is more in line with what they've been expecting over the past few quarters and what they've been able to achieve on a consistent basis. I actually had a rather unpleasant experience with Walmart.com recently, which really made me scratch my head and think about how all of those people, a lot more people are spending money, there are a lot more people doing so, how they're able to get through the process, because for me, it was fairly difficult. I was not on the mobile application. I was on a desktop. And honestly, going to Walmart.com and going through a simple transaction took far too long. And I was actually trying to purchase an e-gift card too. It was extremely difficult. And I got turned back 3 times for this very, very, very simplified transaction, or what should have been a simplified transaction, something that would have taken me about 40 seconds on Amazon's platform. Walmart's goal, as we mentioned during the start of the calendar year, is to have around 40% e-commerce growth average across all 4 quarters this year versus the 50% that they brought in during the last fiscal year. It looks as though they will hit that mark, if not a little bit higher this year. But the question is, the big question, what bar do they set heading into next year? Because that's not far off. That's 1 quarter away. The market has been somewhat negative in terms of what they've been deciding is what is an appropriate comp for Walmart in e-commerce. They dipped into the 30% range for 1 quarter, and shares went in the negative direction very fast. So this is a number that we have to keep an eye on in 2019, or at least the calendar year 2019. According to eMarketer, Walmart could be in the number 3 spot in U.S. e-commerce for sales by the end of the year. This would mean that it would have around 4% of the total U.S. retail online shopping market share. But we have to keep in mind Amazon's over 45% market share in domestic e-commerce. In the bigger retail pie, however, online sales still play such a small part. Amazon's total retail sales make up less than 5% of U.S. retail sales, and Walmart is on pace to be at around 0.4% or better by year's end.
And that 0.4%, we should mention, that's just e-commerce. So Walmart's e-commerce efforts would make up 0.4% of overall U.S. retail sales. But we talked about, or Layton did at least, Walmart dwarfing Amazon in terms of overall sales numbers, just how much larger Walmart's sales numbers are in comparison to Amazon's. overall when you include brick and mortar. And that's one of the things that we oftentimes bring up. E-commerce is important, and I get why the market feels like e-commerce is important for the future. Let us not forget that Walmart is still a massive brick and mortar retail power in the United States, and their sales dwarf those of most of their competitors. Now, management is firm on the idea that online for Walmart should have third-party items and first-party items as well. Amazon, however, has really been promoting the idea that anyone can sell their products on their platform and use their fulfillment centers. Amazon, after all, has promoted that concept, whether or not they believe it, that small businesses are the lifeblood of the U.S. and that their services like AWS exist to help entrepreneurs. Let's not forget that Walmart did a lot with third-party sales, and it didn't go all that well for them in some cases. A lot of analysts were talking about Walmart's online presence being akin to almost a flea market. But when you look overall at what Walmart is doing, management is predicting what everyone else already has to this point. This will be the biggest holiday sales period ever. And this dovetails certainly with those numbers from the NRF and other researchers that we've used here on the podcast. They're primed, they feel like, to take full advantage. And as we noted last week, they're going tech heavy with Black Friday as per usual. According to management, the fourth quarter started off rather strong, and this backs up their assertion that reiterated guidance for the full year was indeed needed. Between heavy advertising and pricing investment, they feel like they're winning over the customer. Consistently low prices in the face of some of that inflation we were talking about, and also in the face of some tariffs. Let us not forget the tariffs that have been such a big part of retail earnings calls for some sectors over the last couple of months. Walmart feels like they're in a good spot to handle a continuation of tariff pressure, something that other retailers in niche retail segments cannot do profitably. We talked about Party City last week, Lumber Liquidators a couple of weeks ago, especially as Chinese imports are expected to hit 25% in terms of tariffs in 2 months for many companies. Whether or not it does remains to be seen. But the big part for Walmart that was explicitly mentioned in the earnings call is that much of their business does come from U.S. made and manufactured consumables. You may see Walmart make a little bit of a return to that in their brand messaging, just as we saw in the 80s and 90s when Sam Walton was still around for Walmart regarding it U.S. production. And in other categories where what they sell is not dominated by U.S. production, Walmart's been looking at U.S. production facilities for discretionary goods. While again not giving specific details, management wanted analysts coming away from the call knowing and thinking that the tariff pressures or margin pressures they may face overall will be dealt with in the long term successfully. Now, shares fell nearly 2% after Thursday's report, settling in at $99.54. It's up only a dollar year to date going back 52 weeks, although up a little bit more than that if you go back further than 52 weeks. Currently around 22 times forward earnings with a $291 billion market cap. Lows this year near $80 a share, highs near $110 a share. So it has been better, has been worse for the retailer in terms of share price. The biggest question, though, for shareholders going forward should really center on what they think the retailer will do in terms of top-line growth in exchange for eroding margins and even more digital investment, which kind of, to this point, was Amazon's MO, although we've seen it turn around for Amazon. Will Walmart kind of commit to that same concept, or will their bottom line begin to once again grow and differentiate itself from others in this space?
We move on with our last story that has to do with groceries, but not staple retail, and Blue Apron, as they have not turned a profit since their IPO and still have not, according to their latest earnings report. And now reports that they are laying off more workers there at corporate and throughout the business. Meal kits have invaded the popular cook-at-home landscape, trying to make it easier for people to prepare their own fresh meals without having to buy too much of any one ingredient at the grocery store. So a simple concept, but one that is popularized within a short amount of time. And so despite that demand, we have seen possible signs this year of market saturation, with some analysts saying that the ceiling for meal kits in general is much, much lower than some initially thought 3 to 4 years ago. And Blue Apron's business plan consists of sending weekly boxes of lunch and dinner meals that are curated to fit one's tastes. They switch up the recipes often, trying to make it easy and fun to try new dishes. By 2016, Trent, they had shipped over 8 million servings, which seems like a lot, But if you look at the amount of consumers there that eat dinner, it really is not a big piece of the retail grocery pie. Their 2017 IPO was highly touted, though, because of their growth. But the company immediately faced pricing pressure, management realignment, and restructuring at fulfillment centers. By the middle of 2018, shares of Blue Apron collapsed more than 75% from the June 2017 IPO price. Fast forward to now, Tuesday of this week, the six-year-old company announced that it would yet again undergo another round of layoffs, laying off around 100 workers in total. This news came with the release of their third quarter earnings, like I said, but first we dive into the layoff details and the company goings-on in general. This represents nearly 4% of their workforce in this latest layoff. This series of layoffs coincides with the last, because the last one happened in October of last year, where they laid off roughly 6% of their workforce, so around 150 to 200 people were laid off at that time. Layoffs are not something common to a business, let alone industry that is looked at as being one that's in a growth state. So this really took us by surprise, because the whole idea last year, Trent, was that this realignment, this layoff, the 6% layoff in 2017 was going to make it such that the company would no longer have to lay off employees going forward. But despite redesigned meals and a small Costco partnership, the company has been churning out poor results, and we would not be seeing employees lose their jobs if they had executed in a bit of a better way. And that's what we're looking to now, is the company is now going to have to pay out more for the severance packages. In fact, $1.6 million in severance packages. However, they say going forward, so going into 2019, they'll be spending around $16 million less in payroll and healthcare benefits. So there is that. But again, we're not looking at a company that should be cutting costs and touting about cost savings. We're looking at a company that should be talking about revenue growth. But we're not seeing that. The employees, like in 2017, will be affected in nearly every business facet, according to CEO Brad Dickerson. So this really is a poor time for the company. But as we head into the company's finances, we have to look at how the company is going to be attracting more members in the future due to yet another realignment.
And it's going to be tough. Look, we don't toot our own horn very often, because we're not right very often, I think. But in this circumstance, we both said on Meal Kits nearly 2 years ago that, look, this is a fine industry for now, but growth prospects are going to be limited, because there are companies that already have scale, that already have distribution, that places like Blue Apron were struggling with that scale, with distribution, with logistics, that could take over in this space. And that's exactly what we've seen. You see meal kits now in just about every grocery store chain in the U.S., and they're priced more cheaply than those Blue Apron meal kits are. And I think that's the big problem for Blue Apron, is how do you cut costs to the consumer and give them a value proposition at the same time you're giving them a quality proposition? To this point, their messaging has been very much about quality, but when you're providing the consumer with a meal that they are cooking for about the same price as they can get a meal at a restaurant, that's not a sustainable business model. And we've seen that through double-digit decreases now in paying membership-based customers, which has made a massive dent in the company's revenue streams. At least part of the reason customers are leaving, besides promotional pricing from competitors, is that their customers began noticing delays that were traced back to supply chain issues. The entire business model is predicated upon a schedule that the customer sets up. And for those individuals who may travel a lot for work and had planned for kits to only be delivered for certain days of the week, you can easily see how any delivery delay is going to be frustrating, going to cut down that loyalty significantly. Looking at the numbers as a whole, percentage decreases in customers have actually grown at certain points sequentially. September drop-offs outpaced August drop-offs. Last week of September saw Blue Apron have 646,000 customers. That is 25% lower versus the same period in time in 2017. While the entire industry has seen some companies decline in revenue and memberships, Blue Apron is up there with the worst in terms of metrics. HelloFresh has actually grabbed market share away from Blue Apron, as they now have over 300,000 more customers than Blue Apron does. In November of last year, to put it in perspective, Blue Apron had 40.3% of the meal kit market share in the U.S. and was number one in the space. As of March of this year, HelloFresh took over the number one spot with 36% of the market and Blue Apron having 35%. Now Blue Apron's number even worse than that. A function of both Blue Apron's mismanagement, or what we perceive as mismanagement, HelloFresh's purchase of competitor Green Chef, who offers organic options, and a third component, which is narrowing of everyone's market share as a result of these additional entrants into the space, the result of purchase of meal kit companies by established grocers and by grocers rolling out their own meal kit services like Walmart, like Kroger has done. Marketing latent, that's another issue. Investors and analysts constantly question customer acquisition costs for Blue Apron because their marketing expenditure is so much. And the rule of thumb being that customer lifetime value is about three times the cost to acquire that customer. Obviously, different industries face different dynamics, but one could easily look at Blue Apron's most recent sales consolidation and say that either they need to spend less on all this advertising that they're doing to right-size their business, or make marketing strategies better to drive up conversion. This, again, in the face of aggressive pricing tactics from competitors like Plated or HelloFresh, they've got to differentiate themselves somewhere.
They absolutely do. And Blue Apron, while promoting the fact that they use some local produce suppliers, to us doesn't do well in terms of having a high level of willingness when it comes to adding more organic or all-natural options to all of their recipes. This is a major flaw. And in this space, this is where companies are trying to capitalize. They're trying to make their food quality a focal point for their consumers. And I think, again, in this space, it is extremely vital, the type of marketing, the type of branding that you have. And I think they are in a well-positioned space to be able to take advantage of having something, say, non-GMO or organic on it. So it appears as though, via an SEC filing, they're at least doing a little bit to address some of the marketing initiatives. Their chief marketing officer has apparently left the company, but according to company remarks, leads us to believe that he left on his own accord. Maybe they could not see eye to eye between the CEO and other executives there, but we look towards marketing as sort of maybe what this company's future is relying upon, because if you can drive up marketing and make it a little bit more efficient, to your point, you don't really have to drive up costs of advertising, but if you make it more efficient, you can drive down the cost to acquire each individual customer and create better lifetime value for those customers. I think it would behoove them to really look at any and all ways they can improve their marketing. We go over some third quarter highlights quickly, and we see that while the company did report a net loss, it was less than last year. It was still $33.9 million because of new warehousing. Gross margins did improve modestly, but one must consider that this improvement did cost them in terms of some supply chain disruption in certain areas because they were building out a new warehouse. There were some delays. There were some angry customers. Net revenue decreased 28% year over year, a bigger deficit than the customer drop-off. Average order dropped by over a dollar to $56.79, while orders per customer also went down 10 basis points. This shows that customers that are staying just don't seem to be as enthusiastic about the offerings as they once were. The staying power of meal kits is really in question here because momentum was strong when they first came out. When this became a thing, this was huge, and a lot of people were saying that it was going to take over, but now sort of wearing off as more of a novelty, something you might do once a month. So total orders for the company hit 2.64 million versus 3.6 million during the third quarter of last year, a major fall for the company. At the end of the quarter, they had cash and cash equivalents of $162.9 million, which does not sound like a lot if you're losing $30 to $40 million every 3 months. And they do have a credit facility, by the way, to pull out of with a maturity date that gets extended into February of 2021 due to some credit restructuring there.
We'd be remiss on Blue Apron if we didn't tell you about key initiatives that they've announced for 2019 to try and turn things around. They include a larger assortment of meals, hopefully what they hope to be a better experience for customers. They want a seamless transaction. I know on and on and on with the buzzwords here. Promotion of brand. They feel like the brand has staying power on the industry. They want to redouble their efforts to that. innovative marketing. Who knows how much that's going to cost? Again, I don't want to be negative here, but it seems like we've heard all of this before. They want to push more strategic partnerships. In our opinion, the strategic partnership part, that's a sound investment if they can get more brick and mortar exposure before every standalone grocery or convenience store has their own meal kit plan, which a lot of them do. Would be nice to have more also with delivery services and tie-ins there like what they have with New York City. They want to drive loyalty and continued consumption in its base. They found that the top 30% of their customers in what they continually spend account for 80% of the company's revenues. We spoke of earlier delays for customers and how some left or vented about the issues. How do you keep them around? You have to make it up to them in a sincere way. Oftentimes this comes at the cost of margins, but it's more valuable to keep them around than to spend all of that money to try and get a new customer only to potentially disappoint them in the future. Now, only time will tell if strategy changes and new management can fix Blue Apron, but as of now, it appears as though the meal kit industry is starting to weed out the weakest players. Not saying that Blue Apron is one of those as yet, but we haven't seen that meaningful differentiation there, either because of lack of innovation or pricing investments through economies of scale. Shares fell this week after Tuesday's announcement by over 2%. Remember that $10 IPO price point? Well, Blue Apron ticker APRN saw shares close on Friday at $1.17. Now, a market cap of $225 million, which is still pretty high to some, seeing as that market valuation is 55% of JCPenney, who has assets still left on its balance sheet. Year-to-date, Blue Apron off 63% in terms of the share price.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I look ahead to a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year, and we begin with Leighton.
My looking ahead has to do with David's Bridal, as they announced Thursday they may be reaching a restructuring plan with their creditors and lenders to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy at an undisclosed time. And this was according to a press release from the Retail Dive. And so the Retail Dive actually had some insights that were pretty interesting about this. But this is interesting because this is an industry that you would think would not be in that much trouble, but they had massive debt on the books. Supposedly, after it's all said and done, if they do file bankruptcy, as they plan to, they will cut around $400 million in debt. And in doing so, Trent, the positive for us, at least, is fans of brick and mortar, is they'll be able to keep all 300 stores open throughout the restructuring process and thereafter. So all of those employees at those brick and mortar locations will be able to save their jobs. My question is this: if they had such a liquidity problem, how do they restructure the business from within and make it more profitable going forward? I think this is something that is going to be a massive question for CEO Scott Key. And he said in a planned statement that the restructuring plan is really a culmination of extensive discussions with lenders, note holders, and equity holders. That's all fine and dandy, but we want to know the details of where you're going to take the business in the future to make it so that these types of hiccups, these financial hiccups, don't happen again. So that's why it's my looking ahead story. And I'm curious to see when exactly they do file for Chapter 11 after this report.
My looking ahead story comes from a story that came out this week regarding Petco, as Petco has announced that they're making a movement to cut artificial ingredients in the dog food and the pet food it sells. Now, this is interesting because they're really the first of the big box pet stores to do this. They're looking at May 2019 as a target date, and they've targeted 40 artificial ingredients, actually more than 40 artificial ingredients to ban. Now, Petco is one of the largest players in the pet retail space. PetSmart, PetSense, also Pet Supplies Plus, all playing in addition to, of course, stores like Walmart, Target, Kroger, and the like in terms of pets. But this is interesting because for Petco, this kind of begins a branding for them akin to what you have in CVS versus Walgreens in the pharmacy space. They're trying to take that moral high road, and I think this is an interesting task for them looking ahead, because there's always kind of this moral ambiguity when it comes to certain pet stores. PetSmart was in the news this last week after a dog died at one of its locations. Of course, you have the puppy mill controversy that has constantly surrounded Petland over the last several years. And so now, looking ahead, can Petco fully establish themselves as a retailer in the pet space that has that moral high ground there? And does it start with this announcement? Does it start with that natural dog food or pet food announcement? We shall wait and see. Also, you know, does it lead to them grabbing market share? And that's ultimately the biggest thing for the company. It's one thing to grab PR market share. It's another thing to have that impact your top line. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week, when we'll roll out a Black Friday edition of the Retail Focus.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.